It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the president of a conservative group that just put out a report on how they'd like to see Wisconsin's tax structure change.
First, what does the story of everyday Milwaukee look like from the cameras of some of the country's top photographers set loose to take pictures of the city for nearly a year?
You can find the answer at the Milwaukee Art Museum's Postcards from America Milwaukee exhibit. It opened this summer. It's slated to close this month on October 19th.
A group of Magnum photographers explore the everyday sights of Milwaukee as part of a countrywide project called Postcards from America. The exhibit in Milwaukee is the first of its kind in a formal museum.
Here with us to talk about the project is Lisa Sutcliffe, curator of photography at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, how did the original idea for Postcards from America come about?
Well, there was a group of photographers associated with the Magnum Photos Agency who were looking for new ways to sort of experiment with the medium and collaborate. So they decided to come together in 2011, and they bought an RV, which they named Uncle Jackson, and they drove from Austin, Texas to Oakland, California, along the border of the United States and Mexico, and photographed and met people and thought about new ways to kind of expand the way they worked.
And so from there on, what is sort of the main idea of this? What are the subjects like, and how do they find them?
So, you know, the project is an evolving one, and the photographers sort of work amongst each other to sort of push the ideas of what they might be looking at. But they're interested in looking at America and at places in America that might fall out of the mainstream news cycles or media. And, you know, I think each person is going to respond differently to what they find in each place. For instance, if you look at someone like Bruce Gilden, he photographs faces close up, and I think that no matter where he is, those pictures are going to look very similar. Whereas someone else, like Donovan Wiley, is going to look at the landscape, and so the landscape will be determined by where he is.
Well, bring this home to Milwaukee. This is your first show as curator of photography, I understand, at the museum.
Mm-hmm.
What made you decide to take this on? What brought the museum and Postcards from America together?
Well, I've been following this project since it began, and I thought it was a really energetic and innovative way of working. It kind of shows what's happening in photography in terms of new models of the bridge between art, photojournalism, you know, engaging community, that kind of thing. So when I first came here in January of 2013, I had sent an email out to a group of photographers I know, letting them know I was coming to Milwaukee. And one of them happened to be coming here as well, and so we met, and it was Martin Parr who was a part of the project, and I at the time invited them to come, and he was thrilled with the idea, and so we put the project together pretty quickly, and within about 5 months, many of them are here and working.
Now, these photographers, as you said, they're often not local, they're outsiders. How does that play into how the photographs come out?
Well, I think we're all you know, aware of what it means to be an outsider in a place, that when you go somewhere new, you see it with a different perspective than someone who might have lived there their entire lives. And there's a real tradition of outsiders in photography from Robert Frank, who photographed on the road in America in the 1950s, to now. So, you know, these photographers come in and they bring their own perspectives to a place. And, of course, the work that they make doesn't define Milwaukee as much as it does show their response to being here for a short period of time.
When we check out the exhibit, is it recognizably Milwaukee? Do we feel a strong sense of place looking at these images?
I think so. I'm new to Milwaukee, so for me it was a great way to get to know the city. But, you know, I've given so many tours and tours to students who've grown up here and to people who've lived here their whole lives. And everyone says, you know, oh, I see that place, but I never saw it in that way before. You know, there's different intersections that they might not have paid attention to, or, you know, the construction projects. Another interesting project is Susan Mizellis, who photographed some of the workers in factories. And, of course, we all know these things are here, but we might not know what it looks like on the inside. So kind of showing us our city from new angles. And definitely some of the projects seem more like very intimate pictures of Milwaukee, and others, as I mentioned, could have been taken anywhere, but it's nice to see that range in the exhibition.
Can you describe some of the photographs that are particularly meaningful to you?
Yeah, so one of my favorite projects was done by Jim Goldberg, who is a photographer from San Francisco, and he put out a call for Milwaukee's best citizen. And of course, that's a very subjective term. What does that really mean? So we put the call out on Craigslist and on Facebook and through word of mouth, and so he got lots of volunteers from around the community. And he made Polaroids, which are small 4x6 images where he then asked them what their talents were and had them write on the pictures. So you have someone who says she's the best cook that God ever made, and you have, you know, the best student at Alba Elementary School, and each of them gets to write on the picture in their own words. So they have a very intimate feel to them, and you know, if you spend a lot of time with them, you get a real sense of the humanity, the unsung heroes of our city.
Well, it's interesting back and forth between the photographer and the community there. Were there other things like that where it wasn't just going out and finding shots, but trying to kind of work the community in?
Yeah, so one of my favorite things about the project was that the two art schools in town, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design, collaborated to form a class associated with the project, and all of the students acted as assistants to the photographers. So they worked with them, they helped them make their pictures, find their subjects, they did a lot of research for them, they drove them around. The artists went to a lot of different community centers, and we had people from all over the city who, you know, maybe hadn't been to the museum before and then were in pictures that ended up in the exhibition. So it's been really fantastic to see how we could involve many different parts of the community.
What do you think natives of Milwaukee see in these pictures that they might not have noticed about themselves or their city?
You know, I'm not sure, but I think the nice thing is that it's going to be different for each person, because I think in a lot of ways we have emotional ties to place. You know, and a lot of your memories about a place or about what happened there with the people you know and love. So getting to see how someone else experiences that place and seeing it afresh would be different for each person, I would imagine. But I had one person who actually works at the museum tell me that he lives right around the corner from one of the pictures, and he'd never seen that intersection as such a beautiful kind of impressionistic place before. So it's, you know, it's been interesting for me as an outsider to hear all of these stories from all these different people.
I'm interested in how the photographers work together or not. There's a bunch of them. Do they just all go off in their own direction, or do they bounce ideas? Do they riff off of each other? How much collaboration is there?
So each project is different. In Rochester, they rented a house and all lived together. So at night, they would get around the table and kind of show each other their work and talk. In Milwaukee, they came in three stages. So three photographers came in August, three in January, and six in April. And they all stayed in the same place, but, you know, each day they're kind of out making their work, and then at night they would come in and they'd sort of talk to each other. But I think a lot of it is in the kind of posting to Tumblr and talking to each other about what they're working on, and then sort of pushing each other in different directions and finding out what each person is found here. In a way, the sort of the competition is the thing that kind of drives them, pushes them a little bit harder.
Lisa, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
We've been speaking with Lisa Sutcliffe. She's curator of photography at Milwaukee Museum of Art, looking at the exhibit Postcards from America, Milwaukee. It closes October 19th. The safety of some rail bridges along the Mississippi River has some residents concerned and federal officials questioning the integrity of the structures. Maureen McCollum has more.
The railroads follow the entire stretch of the Mississippi River along Wisconsin. Trains travel next to highways, pass through towns, and cross the river on lines owned by BNSF Railway. An average of 36 trains carrying more than 1 million gallons of crude, Bakken oil, travel these rails weekly. Recently, members of the group Citizens Acting for Rail Safety, or CARS, decided to check out some of the bridges south of La Crosse. What they saw concerned them.
This would scare everybody that we're hauling this kind of fuel down these rail bridges.
CARS member Guy Wolf found bridges with crumbling concrete and exposed rebar. One bridge was held up with stacked wooden beams. Flipping through a pile of photos of the rail bridges, Wolf acknowledges that he's not an engineer, but he wants a more thorough investigation.
We're radically concerned that these bridges have not been inspected properly, that they pose a significant threat, primarily because they are, in fact, carrying high-level, you know, flammable material, over 1 million gallons of oil every single day down the river.
Railway companies must inspect the tracks they own. In this case, it's BNSF. BNSF denied several requests for an interview, but in an email, a spokeswoman says all bridges are inspected at least once annually. If an inspector and structural engineer identify a major deficiency, the company then decides whether to fix the bridge or replace it. Rail companies submit their inspection reports to the Federal Railroad Administration, which then evaluates them. Multiple requests to speak with FRA officials on bridge safety and inspection protocols were denied. An FRA spokesman said in an email that the agency can perform safety inspections on the bridges. It will issue emergency orders to remove or limit rail traffic if a bridge is found to be a serious hazard. CARS members recently met with Senator Tammy Baldwin in La Crosse about the issue. She sent a letter to the FRA this week requesting inspection reports on the bridges near La Crosse.
I mean, it's hard to believe that they were adequately done when you see the images, but I want to hear from authorities about what guarantees they can give us that these inspections are done on an annual basis, that they are comprehensive, that there is a plan in place for reconstruction of bridges that are showing signs of failing.
Senator Baldwin is pushing for more federal funding to hire additional rail inspectors and boost the inspection program along oil shipment routes. CARS members also brought the bridge photos to the attention of U.S. Secretary of Transportation Anthony Fox when he was in La Crosse last week. Fox says the bridges are part of the overall problem with infrastructure in the country.
Regular people all around the country are going to have to start speaking up. I mean, these bridges that I saw, the pictures that I saw, these bridges that have been held up by trusses, it's just, it's hard to believe it's America. You know, you could believe it's a third world country, but this is the United States of America, and we do better than that.
After viewing the photos, FRA officials who were also at the meeting but could not be interviewed said they would send an inspection team to Wisconsin this week to examine the bridges along the Mississippi River. Maureen McCollum, Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse.
Election Day is weeks away in Wisconsin, and one group is giving suggestions to the next governor. The Wisconsin Policy Research Institute just commissioned a report to look at changing taxes in the state. Their suggestions? Cut income tax some more and shift some taxes from one source to another.
Here to talk about that report is Mike Nichols. He's the president of the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute who commissioned that report. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So this report is coming out on the eve of the midterm elections. Why now?
So we started out about a year ago, actually, thinking to ourselves, we should really step back and look at an important issue here, which is, do we have the right tax level in the state, but also do we have the right tax mix? Do we ask people to pay the right kind of taxes in order to, best produce economic prosperity, jobs, income growth, investment growth, down the road? We feel like too often we make decisions on tax policy based on sort of, short-term, ever-changing projections of deficits and surpluses that may or may not turn out to be true. So, part of it is the study's just ready now, but I will say, we could have held off until after the election was over. I certainly wouldn't have wanted to have put it out any closer to the election, but, there's a big part of me that feels like, hey, right now is the time actually when people are tuned in. It's when people actually care about, revenues and care about taxes and, all those other related issues. So people are paying attention, and so we thought it was, a good time to put it out there.
One of the things the report takes on is comparing how Wisconsin tax policy stacks up against other states. What did you find?
So the most recent stuff we have is actually from the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, which is kind of the gold standard around here and very objective. And so they put out some numbers in 2014, which is actually based on 2011 data. So I want to make that clear, and then I can tell you what I think has happened since 2011. But in 2000, earlier this year, what the Taxpayers Alliance came out with is that, we still have a very high tax burden in this state in comparison to other states in the country. That over overall, and this is as a percent of personal income, in other words, the percentage of your income that you pay in taxes, we're about the 11th highest in the country. So we're still extremely high. Now, again, that's based on 2011 numbers. Those numbers also said that, in particular, we have very high property and individual income taxes. And, you know, the other big tax that we have, of course, in this state is our general sales taxes. And we have those at the statewide level and then also at the county level. We're very, very low on that. And, you know, there are a couple different ways to look at this. We're about 30, I think it's sixth in the country if you look at, you know, the contribution that each of us as individuals make as a percent of personal income in general sales taxes. But if you just look at rates, you know, the average for us, you know, if you factor in local taxes along with state taxes, is about 5.4%. We're actually 44th in the United States in that, so very low sales taxes, very high income and high property taxes. Now, I'll just very briefly, I mean, we're probably in a little better position on income and property taxes since 2011, because there have been some tax cuts in the last couple years. But if you look at what the overall, you know, tax burden is in this state and what the reductions have been and what's been happening simultaneously in other states, you know, we're probably still in the top third in terms of highest taxed in the country.
Give us a 101 here. How does the tax burden in a state affect its overall economy?
So it affects it in all kinds of ways. Obviously, we need taxes. I mean, there are a lot of government functions and services that are absolutely essential, but there are also ways that, you know, frankly, you know, taxes take money out of our pocket, and they do that in different ways. So it's money that we don't have to spend in the private economy. So obviously, you know, good things that happen with taxes, but there are also some negatives. And various types of taxes have different types of, I guess, negative impacts on economic activity in the private sector and in general, in job growth and in investment and in the way we, you know, the way that we save money. And so, you know, the easiest way to think about it, I think, is that, you know, sort of the most, you know, harmful, I guess, taxes to economic growth and development over time are probably income taxes. Because when you think about it, you know, what you want to do as little as possible is tax work. You know, you don't want to have a disincentive for working. And income taxes also tax saving. It makes it harder to save. And savings are important because, you know, savings are enable investment in the economy. So, you know, so various taxes have various impacts, and what the economists will say, and it's not just the ones that we used for this study, is that, you know, what we want to do is not have super high in comparison to other states' income and property taxes, and probably better, although there are some negatives to it, but better to focus on consumption taxes, you know, sales taxes, for instance, to a better degree, as long as that's done the right way.
You've got some changes based on your report. What do you think needs to change in Wisconsin?
So we think there's still a need in this state for there just to be lower taxes, lower property taxes, and lower income taxes. We're still a highly taxed state. You know, when you're high in comparison to other states, it's hard to attract capital, and that's important. So we think that those taxes still need to be brought down, but we're not just going out there and saying, oh gosh, you know, we just need to cut, and there's no other alternative. I mean, you know, we understand that there are, you know, sometimes limitations that are either based by, you know, the needs of government or by politics where that's not going to be possible. So we also looked at what I think is another really interesting question, which is, you know, if we change the tax mix, you know, the extent to which we tax people in those individual categories of taxes, you know, could we get more of a sort of an economic kick long term through that? And so we asked the economists to do some from Boston to do some modeling on different tax mixes as well.
Okay, and what would those be? So for cutting, according to your plan, property taxes, income taxes, where does that go? Where do we get the money that we would have gotten there?
So there are two different things. I just want to make sure I understand the question. I mean, so we looked at a bunch of different, you know, scenarios. One is just, you know, some of them, one category is just, you know, tax cuts, and the other is, you know, revenue neutral scenarios that wouldn't be a loss of revenue to the government, but it would still be economically advantageous. So two different things there.
And you're hoping, though, to shift this, you said, to some to the sales tax arena.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about what that would be?
Sure. So if there's a shift, and this, it's a good question. I'm glad you asked it, because people, there'll be a couple of immediate criticisms. You know, oh my gosh, we can't raise the sales tax rate, even though we're lower than elsewhere. We're already, at five statewide, or 5.5 in some places. And there's going to be some negative impacts of raising the sales tax rate, and that's true. But what we feel is overlooked is the fact that we have a very narrow base on our sales tax. You know, there are a lot of areas that are exempt, or some that have never paid sales taxes. So what economists will tell you is that you want a broad base, not a narrow base. So, we asked the economists to run some scenarios wherein we just had a kind of a broader base where, there weren't so many carve-outs for various people or groups or things or industries.
And Mike, we're gonna have to hit pause right now. I'm sorry. We'll come back to that answer and continue our discussion. We're talking with Mike Nichols of the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute about the group's report with suggestions on how to change Wisconsin's tax structure. And we're taking your calls on this after the news. What do you think about the current tax system in Wisconsin? What needs to change? What do you think about changing the sales tax measures? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You're listening to Central Time. We're continuing our conversation now with Mike Nichols of the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute. The group just put out some suggestions for how Wisconsin could change its tax policy. And we're taking your calls now. What do you think of this new plan to cut taxes further and change what gets taxed? What do you think of Wisconsin's current tax structure, and how would you change it if you could, and why? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Mike, I want to go back to you and pick up the rest of your thought there. Before the news, you were talking about some language mentioned in the plan to change the sales tax rates in Wisconsin, including in the plan, moving them to some areas that are currently not being taxed, areas like fees on attorneys, lawyers, and beauticians. Do you want to talk some more about that?
Sure, and I'll just touch on it briefly, because you asked how we might shift to consumption or sales taxes, and there's a way to do it without actually raising the sales tax rate. We could actually bring the rate down, but broaden the base, is how the economists refer to it, by expanding sales taxes into some areas that don't currently pay. So, it's something we think that is worth looking at. We'd still be competitive on rates, but we could still shift some of the burden away from high income and property taxes to sales taxes.
So broadening the base, can you go into a little more depth about what exactly that means and what would be taxed?
Sure. So if you want to see the report, there's a whole list, and I don't want to bore you with all the things that are exempt in our sales tax, but I'm opening up our report right now because I never can remember all of them. But it's at our website, which is www.wpri.org. The whole thing is there, and there's a table of items that that are currently exempt in our sales tax. And there are some that are not in here that we didn't include, and we're not, and I can just read the list, but we're not advocating for, that we include things, specific things right now that are currently exempt, but we're just, because that's kind of, you're going to get into a big political debate about that, but what we are saying is, in general, that if you eliminate as many exemptions as possible and sort of eliminate these carve-outs, that's the best thing economically and the fairest thing as well. So, there are all kinds of things that are exempt from the sales tax, and it ranges from, big stuff like, motor fuels and food, labor input into construction, all the way down through, a lot of professional services, legal services, architectural accounting services, as you mentioned. And then, there are just a whole variety of other sort of, relatively smaller things, but things that are still, tens of millions of dollars a year, beauty, in barber, barber shops, veterinarian services, health clubs, funeral services. So, you can see I go through this list, and mm-hmm. people who are involved in these industries are probably getting up in arms already about it. But there'd be a fight, there'd be some consternation. But the economists say that that long term, it's better to expand the base, focus on what we call consumption taxes rather than income taxes.
Okay, we're going to go to our phones now, and we've got George with us from Fenimore. Hi, George.
Hi. I'm from Texas.
Oh, George, are you still there? I think we may have lost you on your cell there. Yep, I'm not hearing George. So, George, maybe you can call back when you've got a little better reception. I think what George was getting at was suggesting that Wisconsin adopt the Texas model. You want to talk briefly about that, maybe raising the sales tax, eliminating income tax. What do you think?
So there are some there are states, I think there are six states that do not have income, do not have personal income taxes. And there are about the same number that don't have corporate income taxes. So, and I'm trying to recall if, which one is the case in Texas. Do you know? Is
The Texas state sales tax uses a tax rate. It's at 6.25%. May also impose sales tax and up to 2% of the minimum combined rate of 8.25. Now, does that make any sense to you?
Well, so, you know, what you have to look at here is not just the rate, but also the base at what's taxed. And so you'll have some states like Washington State is one I'm more familiar with that than Texas, to be honest with you. And Washington State just has a very broad base and a high rate as well. So, you know, so it's kind of a combination of looking at both in most places. But maybe George, if you called back, could fill us in on what his question is specifically about Texas.
Gotcha. Let's move on to Jacob in Wausau. Hi, Jacob.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on the air.
Sure.
I was just wanting to bring up the flat tax. Why have we not moved towards that, you know, an even tax that goes from the poorest to the richest just as a flat tax?
You know, we traditionally have a pretty progressive tax structure here, and you know, more progressive here than in comparison to most other states. There have been a number of studies on that. So, you know, in general, folks will argue that a progressive tax structure is probably better for folks at the lower end of the economic spectrum. It's probably why, you know, a lot of states have not gone to a flat tax. You know, the other side of the argument is that, you know, long-term economically that, there'll be some positive economic growth from that flat tax, but we didn't focus on that in this study.
Thank you, Jacob. And we're going to move on to Joe in Wausau next. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I would like to mention how lowering income tax and raising sales tax disproportionately affects the poor, in that people on a lower income level already don't pay a lot of income tax or almost no income tax. But raising sales tax on services like veterinary care and legal advice and financial planning and funerals, which are already expensive services, will push those services further out of the reach of people who are already struggling. And so their tax burden for people who struggle financially would actually go up.
Right.
So, thanks, Joe. And Joe is putting his finger there on some criticism that the report has received, that this would perhaps disproportionately hurt lower income families.
Right. So I'm really glad you asked the question. Great question. So two things. And one is just that long term, we see more economic opportunity, you know, more job growth, income growth across the board, and that helps everybody. However, yes, you know, economists will argue about the extent to which an increase in sales taxes, consumption taxes, will make a tax system more regressive. But in general, you know, most of them will concede that to some extent it becomes more regressive. And I'm not going to argue with that. I would say in fact that of course it's a very valid policy goal to help folks at the lower economic strata. We want to make sure things are equitable and fair. There are a couple other ways to do that, and they are done to some extent in this state that are probably, you know, worth exploring further. Things like the homestead credit, which can apply not just to people who own homes in this state, but also people who rent or earned income tax credits. You know, a lot of talk about that. That's a way to kind of target folks, you know, who are specifically in need at the lower end of the spectrum. So there are other ways to make a tax system, I guess, less less regressive. But then I just, but I would go back and reiterate that we do have a pretty progressive tax system in this state, and it would remain that way.
And Mike, briefly, what do you hope the next governor of Wisconsin takes away from this report?
You know what? I hope they'll just sit back, no matter who it is, and think about what's best long term for prosperity and for the economy in this state. And I guess it's hard in politics to get beyond today and tomorrow, and particularly at this time in the election cycle. But we never seem to get really beyond beyond the moment. And we just think that we all need to step back and take a more sober look long term at what's best and how we really aren't measuring up. We really aren't competing with other states the way that we're capable of competing.
Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Thanks, Veronica.
That was Mike Nichols, president of the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute, who is with us to talk about the group's new report on taxes in the Badger State.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. Each fall, the nation's biggest cranberry crop is harvested from Wisconsin marshes, and floods of travelers turn up to celebrate the star of the show. Emily Bright shares the view from her corner of Wisconsin.
My town of Eagle River has a population of 1,398. If our town's population were a year, we'd still be in the Middle Ages. So it's that much more amazing that every year 40,000 people show up on the first weekend of October for Cranberry Fest. 40,000 people drive across the state and beyond to engage in a frenzy over a little red berry that hardly anyone eats raw.
It becomes a pilgrimage. Every year people come up here from all over. They meet each other from many different areas. So it's a time to come together and enjoy everything.
That's Kim Emerson, executive director of the Eagle River Area Chamber of Commerce and Visitor Center. Unlike Eagle River's other events named for produce, the strawberry and apple festivals, for instance, Cranberry Fest is actually timed with the local harvest. The town goes crazy for cranberries. They show up in every restaurant, in sauces and salad dressings, and every kind of baked goods.
Every year I go and I'm like, oh, it's cranberry fritter time. So, and the cranberry brats, that's the other thing that you really like to get a hold of.
There are other things that draw people to Cranberry Fest. The arts and crafts show boasts 325 booths. There's also a fiber art show, a library book sale, and a fun run called the Cranberry Bog Jog. Mostly the events really are tied to cranberries, like the world's largest cranberry cheesecake, over 100 feet long, the proceeds of which go to the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Visitors can also take bus tours of a cranberry marsh and a winery where they can sample cranberry wine. Then they are given ample time in the gift shop.
I think people are more entranced with the color than they are the actual fruit.
Benjamin Riker is assistant manager of the James Lake Cranberry Marsh.
It's part of like the fall culture, leaves change, pumpkins, chai, tea latte, whatevers, and cranberries.
Admittedly, cranberries are cool. They're one of the few indigenous fruits to North America. Cranberries float, which is why bogs are flooded for harvesting. And they bounce, which farmers use to help sort the good berries from the bad. Fruits that aren't sold fresh can go into anything from juice to baby food to vitamins to face wash. If I forget about a pound of cranberries in my fridge, they're still good a month later. For those of us who live in Eagle River, Cranberry Fest is a clear dividing point for the year. After this weekend, the last of the warm weather tourists and snowbirds head south. Resorts close, and many restaurants cut back their hours. It gets pretty quiet around here. We have a few weeks to enjoy the fall by ourselves before hunting and snowmobile season bring the next wave of visitors to the North Woods.
Emily Bright is a freelance writer, educator, and radio producer living in Eagle River.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a collaboration between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org or check out the Wisconsin Life Facebook page.
For the last 2 years, a project in Milwaukee has worked to help senior citizens overcome a sense of social isolation using art.
The project, called Islands of Milwaukee, includes theater, visual art, and interactive online features. An exhibit at Milwaukee City Hall shares the stories and the art that came out of the project.
Ann Basting joins us now. She's a professor of theater at UW-Milwaukee, author of Forget Memory, Creating Better Lives for People with Dementia, and creator of the Islands of Milwaukee Project. Ann, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
So why did you decide to tackle the problem of isolation?
You know, it's a phenomenon that's a growing phenomenon. There's a great book that I read a couple of years ago by Eric Kleinenberg called Going Solo. It turns out that more than ever before in the history of our country, and really other countries as well, we are living alone. And that's a great thing. We're a country of independent people. We like to pull ourselves up and stand our ground. But it also can mean, you know, we are also social beings and we need each other. We need to be in relationship. And sometimes older adults with just in the, you know, snap of a finger, in the blink of an eye, things can change. And that sense of independence can become isolation.
So what kind of things did you do to reach out to seniors?
Well, we first of all, we gathered partners. We wanted to really study the systems that are in place to reach people. So we partnered with the Milwaukee County Department on Aging, which offers just a plethora of incredible programs, interfaith older adult programs, and also STOL Associates, which provides care-managed home care, and then Goodwill of Southeastern Wisconsin, which offers contracts out with the county to run their home-delivered meal program. So we spent a good year with my students at UWM and then also with Sojourn Theater, which is a professional theater company, studying those systems to figure out where we could pour creativity in, almost like water into the system to reach people who are out there living alone.
So what were some of those creative things that you poured into the system there?
We really ended up with a really super simple approach that we think can just keep going on and on. Our goal was to create a sustainable system, something that could just stay in place, not to offer something and then roll it back up and pull it back. And the thing that we found was something we came to call the questions of the day, which are just really simply, poetically, playfully worded, thoughtful questions that people could answer right on a little card or by phone. And we have what we call the Islands line, and people could call in. So over the course of since last November, we pulled a lot of those voicemails and created short little audio pieces with WWM's Lake Effect aired some of them, but they're also all on our website for people to hear. And then in the exhibit down at City Hall right now, you'll see all those beautiful, beloved handwritten cards that people took such care and time answering and that we're really happy to share with people.
And once somebody started participating in this way, did they keep coming back?
You know, we get whenever we would get, say, a voicemail that someone would leave their name and number, we would call them. We took that as a hint, you know, I'd like a call back. So we would call them back and we'd ask them, we'd thank them for participating and we'd ask them, are you interested in maybe having an artistic house call of some sort? We really loved your answer. It was creative. And we went a little deeper with some a tier of people who were involved in the project. One of them worked with Chelsea Waite, the graduate student who was working on the project, to do some paintings. She also wrote some poems with us and came to another performance that we had last May. Another gentleman sang with us, and we invited an interfaith volunteer then to sing and record singing over his track, and then we subsequently shared it back with him. So we would create and connect and use the arts to bring people together.
I love that idea of the artistic house call. How did people respond when, I mean, I assume you arranged it in advance and didn't just show up, but how did people respond having an artist or somebody writing with them in their own home?
You know, I think the people who said yes have a certain openness to it, so they really just embraced it. But rightly so, many people preferred just to use the cards or just to leave a voicemail. you can be and feel a little vulnerable out there living alone, or a lot of people have disabilities, and that's one of the reasons that there can be a sense of isolation, is because they're not feeling real confident or secure with other people. And so we went slow and established relationships in that way. And there are a lot of people following what we do through that, really through the relationship already established with the home-delivered meal drivers, say, for example. So we would pull the writing off of all those cards. Chelsea did a beautiful little booklet where she put all the answers of the questions of the day in a little booklet that we sent back out with the meal drivers, so that the people who were responding to the cards could see that they were part of something much bigger.
That's interesting. So there's the internet angle, and that's what I was able to see. So somebody might send in a picture that went online and then the answer there. But you kind of did an old-fashioned internet too, where it was just a note card traveling back and forth.
Yeah, and it's so, you know, you also, one of the things I loved was seeing the handwritten cards, because we don't, in the age of internet, you don't see handwriting. And you can feel the thought and the labor behind a lot of the responses when you're reading the handwriting on the cards. One of the things that was hard for the UWM students and even for the Sojourn, the actors and performers, was to realize we can't just do this on the internet. A lot of community engaged projects happen on the web now because it's such a broad reach. But even the volunteer systems through Interfaith, which are amazing, they have a telephone reassurance program and kind of a home visit program just to keep people company or give people rides different places. Even their volunteers don't necessarily use the internet. So we were calling people or using their newsletter system in order to get in contact and to really train them how to use creative engagement to improve their relationships and make their volunteer experiences deeper and better.
This was a Milwaukee-specific project. Every community is dealing in one way or another with the issue of isolation for some of their seniors, especially those living alone. Is this something you think could be cloned and taken elsewhere? And has anybody asked you how to set it up in their community?
We have. We've gotten lots of requests. There are, in fact, particularly the home-delivered meal system, which other people might know better in other cities as Meals on Wheels. And I think it's a really great potential for expanding and, like I said before, kind of pouring creativity into it and to be able to use that system as a way to really deepen that 30-second meal delivery relationship into something a little more playful, a little more meaningful and purposeful in that way. And I really look forward to it. We kind of saw this one as a pilot, in some ways a big pilot and an exciting pilot, but one that would help us establish a system that then we could either consult with other cities or people can look and see what we did as well, and we're happy to talk to them.
And if people out there in the Milwaukee area want to participate still, this is still going, how do they get in touch?
Well, if you're on the web, you can take a peek at islandsofmilwaukee.org, and that tells the story of all the questions of the day that we use so far are on there, and you can still answer them. So if you're an envoy for someone, say you have a neighbor, and you know they live alone, but you don't know how to have a conversation with them, say, you know, there's this project. I have a question of the day. Would you like to hear it? Is what we've been saying. Huh. And simply use it as a way to open conversation. Or if you have a parent who's far away, or there's all kinds of people hopefully it'll work well for you.
Anne, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this project.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
That was UW-Milwaukee Theater Professor Anne Basting talking about the Islands of Milwaukee project. The exhibit she was talking about will be at Milwaukee's City Hall through October 20th.